Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know what? We've all watched the Weather Channel and seen storm riders, and on the Discovery Channel, there was storm chasers. They're really cheap and easy reality shows to do for TV where they follow people around who are chasing severe weather, generally out in Tornado Alley and trying to find tornadoes. So that's something we've gotten used to, and after a while, you get more than you want of it, I suppose. But my guest today is somebody who's really into that. Her name is Chris Kreidler. She's a longtime columnist for Florida Today newspaper who recently went out on her own as a freelance photographer and writer-editor and now a novelist. She's written a book called Funnel Vision. It's a novel based on, as you might surmise from the title, storm chasing. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks so much, Court.
So this book is based on Chris's true passion, which is storm chasing, and we're going to talk about the book and also about, Chris, your own adventures in chasing severe weather over many years, and also about the brave new world of self-publishing, which this book is an example of. I've had a number of authors on before with excellent books who have self-published because the publishing industry has kind of turned upside down like so many industries have been in the last 10 years or so. Well, the book is very well written and has several strong characters, and I'm not sure, having read it, whether it's a love story set in the context of storm chasing or a storm chasing story with a love story in the background. What do you think, Chris?
You know, I think that's a really good question. I think it's both. It's a question I've asked myself. I've resisted calling this book a romance, though it has strong romantic elements. Hmm. And I would say that's both in the relationships between the characters and in the way I describe the storms, because I tend to wax rhapsodic, because that's how I think of the supercells on the Great Plains. So I think it's fair to call Funnel Vision a romantic adventure, both in the capital R literary romantic sense, because of the way I treat the storms and the landscape, and a small R in the love story sense, though without giving anything away, it doesn't really have a conventional romance novel structure.
Yeah, so we don't want people to think that it's a romance in the sense of, I don't know these people's names, but Belva Plain or somebody. It's not, you know, it's not a girly story at all. And the tornado chasing aspect of it is, you know, is pretty high adrenaline. And so it's a good read. Could you give us a quick Cliff Notes version of the story, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. You know, it really tells the story from the points of view of two characters, a woman and a man. Judy is an artistic Kansas photographer. She's never really felt safe since she and her sister survived a tornado when they were kids, and Jack Andreas, who's a really smart tornado researcher working on his PhD, he's battling his own demons. Just as Judy wants to recreate and understand that disaster of her childhood, Jack wants to lose himself in the power of the storms. So their paths cross with each other, and then they cross with Judy's flirty sister, a bunch of other storm chasers, this clueless storm tour operator who kind of provides comic relief and is crucial to the storylines that come together at the end of the story in this climactic chase of a monster storm.
Well, Jack also loses himself in the pursuit of women. He's a pretty sexy guy. And is he a fairly common type among storm chasers? I mean, he's very intensely focused on the storm chasing part, and as you said, is very smart and competent at doing it, but he's also got this kind of wild, sort of almost ski bum side to him in a way, you know, and he kind of like moves from girl to girl real quickly. And is that a common type among storm chasers at all, or is he sexier than most of those guys really are?
Well, you know, I'd say he's exceptional in every sense, not just because he has this uncanny instinct for finding tornadoes, but because he has this insatiable appetite for women and for drink, and he is sexy, and he uses that to his advantage. That said, there are a lot of type A guys who are probably just as obsessed with chasing storms as he is. There are female chasers who are obsessed, too. I'd say I'm probably one of them, but we approach it a little differently. We're not maybe as competitive as the men are, and there are still far more men than women who chase storms. So Jack is unusual, but there are elements of Jack in a lot of chasers.
Even in the storm chasing stories on TV, typically it's two guys who are focused on the technology and watching the storm develop on their iPhones, and they're very much like hunters, basically. So the women, are they hunters or are they more seekers? That's a weird distinction to make.
I hate to generalize because we all want to get that storm. You know, we all want to be there and be in the right place and see the spectacular show. I do think some of the men are maybe more tornado-oriented, and it's all about the tornado. And it's not true of all of them. That's just a subset of the community. And then there are some of the men and a lot of the women, too, just love to experience the storm, the beauty of it, being out on the road, experiencing the plains, all of that good stuff.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Is it, you know, mainly really a search for tornadoes, or do chasers have a broader interest in all kinds of severe weather, and tornadoes are just at the top of the food chain, you know, kind of the holy grail? I think you partly answered that, but is everybody really interested in seeing the EF5 tornado?
Well, everybody wants to see the tornado, but the tornado is really the icing on the cake. It's just a really small part of a chase and the whole chasing experience. If you think you're going to go out there and chase storms and see a tornado every 5 minutes, like in a certain movie we're all familiar with, it's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Most chasers still appreciate, you know, a beautiful rainbow or great storm structure. That's my favorite kind of storm. If you have a gorgeous rotating supercell, you get great storm structure. I do feel that sense of failure when I miss a tornado, though, but missing them is all part of the game, and you know, you have to love the whole experience or it's just not going to be fun for you.
And clouds alone can be amazing. You know, there's a that I ran across a year or so back called the Cloud Appreciation Society. You're probably familiar with it. That's based in the British Isles. And you can go there and see every kind of, you know, the taxonomy of clouds, all the different types and extreme versions of all of them, because people from around the world send in photographs. And I have to admit, I've sent in a couple of photographs to the Cloud Appreciation Society.
Oh, that's cool.
But looking on your website, and by the way, Chris has a couple of websites, chriskreidler.com, and it's chriskreidler.com. And that has, you know, excerpts from her book and some storm chasing blogs. And then Sky Diary, spelled like it sounds, skydiary.com, which has stories and photos and lots of photos. And Chris is an excellent photographer. So, you know, some of these magnificent structures of clouds that look like gigantic living creatures or, you know, or bizarre
and
artistic, you know, Escher etchings or something like that, you know.
Yeah, and you just, the best place to see that structure is Tornado Alley, because you get those beautiful rotating storms.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with storm chaser and author Chris Kreidler about her career as a storm chaser and about her book, Funnel Vision, which came out recently. So how long have you been chasing storms, Chris?
I started chasing storms in 1997. I actually took a tour with Cloud Nine Tours, which they're still around. There were only a couple of tours back then. And I got totally hooked. Just seeing that those magnificent storms in the plains was like nothing I'd ever seen before. And so I've traveled to Tornado Alley every year since. And I meet up with friends or I go alone, but I just have to go.
How often do you do it?
I do it every spring. It depends on the year how much time I actually get to invest, but I try to go for at least a couple of weeks. Last year, I got to go for almost 4 weeks, which was fantastic.
Mm. Do you go alone when you're out driving around? I mean,
well, I'll drive out to Tornado Alley on my own, usually. I like to hook up with friends, and so frequently I've met up with friends and we'll chase together. But, you know, if it's one of those days where they want to go to Oklahoma and I want to go to the Texas Panhandle, then that's what we do, because it's very kind of free and easy going. It's an interesting community because so many people know each other from online or just from meeting every year in the spring. So it's kind of fun. You run into people you know all the time because, of course, everybody is in the neighborhood of the storms.
But watching the shows on TV, and of course they edit it down to the most intense parts, but it makes it look like it could be somewhat dangerous to be alone, because you got to be watching the storm and the track of the storm and how it's developing and driving, and not running into the tractor trailer coming at you, or not running off into a ditch, or not missing the little road that will get you out of the path of the storm. And so is it dangerous to go alone if you're really in some serious weather?
You know, it's always better to have somebody else there to navigate and kind of watch your back. At the same time, you know, you can do it safely by yourself. You just try not to do all the multitasking while you're driving. You pull off and then you check your maps and your data. And
okay.
So, and the other thing is, I'm not one of those people who likes to drive into the tornado. So, you know, I play it pretty safe, and I still see a lot of good stuff.
Is it an expensive pursuit for a freelancer?
Yes, it can be very expensive, but it's kind of a sliding scale as far as how much you want to spend. Hmm. Of course, gas money is probably the biggest thing these days.
Yeah.
Some people are turning their cars into tanks, or at least installing serious hail guards, which I would love, given my experiences with hail. But I haven't done that. People are webcasting live during chases. All that takes equipment and buying services. You know, I'm probably on the lower end of the tech scale. I have cameras and radios. course, I have a laptop for GPS and data. And these days, cellular coverage is actually good enough that in a lot of the planes, you can use an air card and get radar data right in your car. The hobby's changed a lot over just a few years.
Wow. Can somebody with a lower tech equipage follow the high tech people and just kind of listen to them on the radio and decide where they're going? Or can you pretty much, with even with low tech technology that's relatively inexpensive, figure out where you need to go?
Well, yes and yes. Following other people is really not a good idea if you don't know what you're doing. And I think more and more people are doing that, maybe partly because they see it on TV and they're like, oh, there goes somebody, you know, they've got all the antennas, and they're like, oh, I can chase them and see a tornado. But you can easily get into a bad situation if you do that and you don't understand the way the storm works. In the old days, I'm sure the old-time chasers just laugh at people like me who came along after, you know, the internet was widely available and everything, because they used to, like, go to the Weather Service office in the morning and they'd make a forecast and they'd use paper maps and they would, you know, just kind of pick an area and then use their eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, you can chase with very little technology. It's just that technology makes it much easier to be successful now.
Using your eyes, you can see what's visible, but if it's a state away, you can't see it, and that's where the internet comes into play, because you can see things developing that in the morning the National Weather Service office and out in some farm area didn't know about 4 hours earlier or something, you know.
Yeah, and with radar, especially if there's low visibility, I mean, you can see if a storm is actually looking better on radar two counties away, and you can actually get there and drive to it. In the past, you might not even know it was there.
So what is the mix of people, types, you know, of people that you meet out there? Is there a hierarchy kind of professional meteorologists and faculty and student researchers and then hobbyists and then rank amateurs who just got excited because they saw some shows and had a vacation they didn't know what to do with and are out there driving around? Is there kind of like a pecking order of these people out there driving around in these small towns?
That's a really good summary, actually. You've kind of hit the cross-section. I don't know about pecking order, but certainly the research projects have the most credibility in the field. You know, they're not out every year, but they'll have caravans of instrumented cars and mobile radar trucks. And there are university chase teams. There are lots of serious hobbyists, at least hundreds, maybe, I hate to think thousands now, but that's possible.
Sure.
And these days there are lots of amateurs and locals who do watch too much TV and maybe think it's easy and safe to chase, which it really isn't. It's good to know what you're doing before you go out there.
So you get into this a little bit in your book, but how do these disparate groups of people and types get along when they're thrown together in these really small one-horse farm towns out there, population of 500, and now there's 100 storm chasers in town or whatever? How do they get along? Do they some of them ignore each other, or, you know, what's the psychology and sociology of that?
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, first, it's great for these little towns' economy because, like, overnight you have 300 people booking up hotel rooms and eating in the restaurants. There is some tension, especially between, I would say, the research folks who feel like they have a really legitimate reason to be chasing a storm and all the other people who also feel they have a legitimate reason, but they aren't doing it for official government-sanctioned research, for instance. The reason there's tension is because there are so many people doing it now, you end up with traffic jams around storms. It's insane. Like, on a little rural highway, you'll get 100 cars. So that causes some tension. But all that said, chasers are really pretty communal, and everybody understands. We all love the same thing. We love to see a great storm. So it's really fun to meet other people, especially when you've really only seen them online, because there's a huge online community. And, you know, you compare your video and you make friends, and it's actually a lot of fun.
Listening to American Variety Radio, I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author and storm chaser Chris Kreidler about her book and about her fun activities and her pursuit of serious, severe weather. What's the best one you've ever seen, regardless of what it is? What's the best thing you've ever seen out there doing storm chasing?
Well, the most intense chase I've had was in May 2004 in Attica, Kansas. I was with friends, and we saw three tornadoes that day. The first one was west of town, this sort of slim white tornado, and we pursued the storm east into the town. The sirens were blaring and big spiky hail was falling, and we could see it was forming another tornado. So we got just east of town, and this tornado formed in a field. And, you know, when it forms in a field, it's very quiet. It's this hushed waterfall sound. So it was really kind of spooky, you know. We were just north of this tornado in the field. And as a rule, if you see a tornado and it looks like it's standing still and maybe getting a little bigger, it's probably coming toward you. And, in fact, that's what was happening. So by then there were four of us in two cars, and we just scooted east a little bit and turned around and filmed this thing as it approached the road. And then we realized that it was about to hit a house, which it did. It ripped this house apart. It pulled the roof off. It was sort of the most graphic destruction I had ever seen. We found out later that the people in the house actually survived in the basement. We were really happy to hear that. And because the storm was still grinding along and was about to produce another tornado, we had a friend call the emergency people, and we kept east and kept parallel with it. It produced yet another amazing tornado, really beautiful in this, you know, dusty field crossing this dirt road. It was sort of poetic. And then as we tried to, again, move east on the same road, it dropped a satellite tornado, which what happens is you get a mesocyclone, you get this area of rotation in the storm, you might have a big tornado in the middle, and that it will drop these little tornadoes on the outside that move really fast. So it dropped one of these little tornadoes on the road right in front of us. That was the only time I ever thought for a minute, gee, where's the nearest ditch? But fortunately, it dissipated pretty quickly. It put down another little one like that, and then we just got out of there. So it was a pretty amazing day.
Is that the most dangerous situation you've been also?
Yeah, I would say so. Because as a rule, I try not to get that close. I mean, it's always a balancing act. You want to get close enough to get the pictures you want and really see what you want to see, but you don't want to be in danger.
You know, you touched on something that actually bothers me some in watching these shows from time to time, that the chasers clearly are rooting for tornadoes to form, and the bigger and badder, the better. And they kind of seem, you know, I'm talking primarily about the male chasers, too. They seem to kind of give lip service to the concern that people and property are about to be blown away. It's really clear that they want the tornado to form, and yet this is a big destructive thing. You know, it's like a hurricane.
Yeah.
It's like a small, intense hurricane, right? So, and what do you say about that? I mean, are chasers generally aware of that? Do they talk about that, the dichotomy between really wanting this powerful thing to happen and yet knowing that that powerful thing is likely to kill some people?
Yeah, I mean, they talk about it all the time because it's an ongoing debate, especially on the online boards, especially because some chasers are kind of portraying themselves as, I don't want to say heroes, but we do relay warnings to the Weather Service. We do try to, you know, relay warnings if we can. Sometimes chasers will stop and help after a disaster, but that doesn't always happen. A lot of times they're just in the way if they do that. Always, I would rather see a tornado in the middle of an empty field, although, you know, if it's a farm field, the farmer's affected by that.
Sure.
The truth is the tornadoes are going to happen whether we're there or not, and so we need to relay warnings and stay out of the way of the emergency services and, you know, just hope that they don't hit any houses. Tornadoes are going to hit cities, and as population grows, it's going to get worse. So really, people have to stay aware and have a weather radio and, you know, make sure they're tuned into warnings.
Yeah, so in May 2011 was, I guess, the worst tornado outbreak since 1927, or at least you probably know the date on that. But anyway, a huge, huge outbreak of tornadoes day after day, dozens of them, you know. And so were you out there then?
I was chasing in May. I did not see some of the big tornadoes. I did see a few tornadoes last May. The Joplin tornado, not a lot of chasers saw that. That day, I knew that was a target area, but I chose to chase in a different area that had fewer hills and trees. That's a choice that chasers make a lot of times. That was a bad one because it was wrapped in rain for at least part of its life, so a lot of people didn't even see it.
So you're trying, I think, to some extent, to edge toward making a living out of storm chasing and the various activities associated with it, like your novel. And with the increase in attention to this kind of adrenaline-based pursuit via TV, is it easier, do you think, than it would have been 5 to 10 years ago to possibly make a living in this sphere?
That's an interesting question. I think people are a lot more aware of the storm chasing phenomenon because there's been so much media attention. That doesn't mean it's easy to make a living at it, except for a few TV stars. the truth is everybody is shooting storm video now. Everybody has cameras. And even people who really should be running inside and taking shelter are standing in the inflow with their cell phone cameras trying to get a killer shot. And sometimes they do dumb things. There was some pretty graphic video from earlier this year of people standing outside in a parking lot while a tornado basically blew over their heads, and a family in their car driving into a tornado. Just dumb things. So video is worth a lot less because there's so much of it out there. And there's also, you know, this mistaken impression that tornadoes won't kill you if you're holding a camera, and I wish people would be aware that, yes, they might actually kill you.
What?
But as for the novel, I mean, I hope it finds the people who are into weather and want to know what it's really like to chase storms. I really do believe there's an audience out there that's hungry for more weather stuff, all of us weather geeks. But there are plenty of books about chasing storms. I actually made one of those Amazon list mania lists of those. There's a lot of nonfiction. There are a few novels. For me, the timing was important because I wanted to get Funnel Vision out there before the technology changed again, because, you know, you have to keep rewriting it with the technology. And I felt more than ready after literally years living with this book, and it just seemed like a good time given the state of publishing. There are a lot of changes right now.
Yeah, you say in your postlog, I guess that's what it is, at the end of the book, that you started writing it before the shows really got going, and that it's been difficult to watch reality overtake one's inventions, you said. And I think
that's right.
So you kind of invented things that would be cool to have as a storm chaser in your book, and then lo and behold, somebody did invent that, and so you had to kind of, keep kind of chasing the technology or whatever. But I don't know how long it took you to write the book, but I'm guessing a span of a few years maybe?
Yeah, I mean, the initial draft took about a year. You know, I had a real job at the time. And so then there were revisions, then there were the supplications to agents. You know, I went through the mill of sending queries for a while, got close a couple of times. And I think part of the issue was that the story didn't scream to be in one genre or another, going to your question of earlier, you know, is it literary, romance, action? The other thing is maybe that built-in audience for weather wasn't as prominent when I was first pitching it. I don't know. So when you're selling books online, now online book sales have surpassed brick-and-mortar store sales. Keywords, I think, are going to be just as important as which theoretical shelf that book is supposed to be on. I had put that book aside for a while, but when I saw how the publishing business was changing, I pulled it out and did another revision to make sure it was good and decided to self-publish it.
Yeah, well, I would guess, all else being equal, that these shows actually have made the timing of your book better because, you know, probably 8 years ago, it would have just been in such a tiny niche that nobody would have known about it or you know, automatically been interested in it. But now there is a much larger base of people who are aware of this and potentially interested in it, I would think.
Yeah, it's like a vernacular now. You know, people understand the terminology and they really get it. So even though, you know, the book has context and you don't have to understand storm chasing to read the book, a lot of people have a certain image in their head now because they've seen it on TV and they kind of, you know, want to know more about it.
Just in general, Chris, what's entailed in self-publishing? I think a lot of people are, you know, there are a lot of writers out there who in the past would have been, you know, would-be novelists who would have sent in, as you said, letters, you know, submission letters to publishers and gotten rejection letters ad infinitum for years or whatever. And, But that whole world is even worse than it ever was because publishing itself has such slim profit margins. And, you know, I think it's just harder if you're not already a blockbuster seller, a Clive Cussler or somebody, but you know, if you haven't already got a huge track record, it's probably really hard to break into publishing. And so there is a greater appeal, and the technology makes it more possible to be self-published. It's not like the old idea of vanity press where, you know, somebody would write their memoir or whatever and it would be terrible, but they would pay some outfit to publish it and they'd make 50 copies and send it to their friends and family or whatever.
Right.
It's not quite the same thing. It's more serious publishing as an alternative form of publishing. So why don't you maybe, Chris, describe for our audience what's entailed in self-publishing? What are the steps and what are the costs, that whole process?
Sure. Well, and I think you hit it on the head when you said it's a more serious publishing now, because to be successful as a self-publisher, it should be a lot like traditional publishing. Only you're the publisher and you're responsible for everything. So you still need a professional-looking cover, and you might need to pay somebody to do that. You know, you can't assume that your cover is going to be good. You know, compare it with other covers in your genre and, and make sure that it's sharp and will look good at a thumbnail size on online.
Mm-hmm.
Get a decent interior design. Obviously, your book has to be good. You have to work with a critique group. You know, get an editor. I've been reading professionally published books recently, ebooks that really could have used a copy editor. So
mm-hmm.
I think editing is falling off in the professional world, and amateurs are stepping up and having to hire editors to make sure that their books can compete.
Mm.
It is terrifyingly easy to upload and publish a book. When I got to that point, I was like, oh my gosh, no one's going to stop me.
Yeah.
You know, it's good to be ready. And then the marketing part is the worst if you're the introverted writer type. You know, I was a newspaper journalist until pretty recently, so I know that people who have a press kit online and easy to find information and professional photos are more likely to get coverage or a mention than someone who's never even heard of the internet.
Hmm.
But the truth is, you do have to do your own marketing, but that's even true of the professional published writer these days. They have to do a lot of their own marketing.
I mean, for one thing, your book is very well edited, and I think it's one of the few books I've ever read where I didn't see a single typo. That's almost incredible. But,
woo-hoo!
I mean, you know, with spell checkers, you get all kind of weird typos that come in because people spell check, and that thing is a word, but it's not the word that should be there.
Oh, you cannot rely on the spell checker.
Right, yeah. So you clearly have read every word twice. But what are the actual steps in, just briefly, you know, in going through
it? You obviously, A, have the good book.
Right.
B, format the book. You have to decide whether you're doing like a paper book, an ebook, or both. I did both because I think there's still interest in both. If you're doing the paper book, you have to make sure the inside's formatted, and you have to pick a service to print the book. The beauty of print on demand these days is that you don't have 5,000 books sitting in your garage waiting to be sold.
Hmm.
They actually print them one at a time. I happen to choose CreateSpace, which is Amazon's service. There are other services out there.
Okay.
So, you know, you upload a PDF, essentially. They send you a proof of your book. You decide whether to make corrections or publish it from there. With the e-books, you can publish direct to Kindle, which is Amazon. You can publish direct to Barnes & Noble. They call it Pubit. You can use other services like Smashwords, which is a little bit thornier to get through, but Smashwords will get it on Apple's iBookstore. It's a little bit more challenging to publish direct to Apple at this point in time. There is a lot to learn. There is a real learning curve, but all the information is online. People are ready to help you out. There are people like David Gulgran, who published a free self-publishing guide. J.A. Conrath is well known as a big cheerleader for self-publishing. These guys all have great information on their website. There's plenty of information out there, and, you know, you can do it.
Well, thanks. That was a good little tutorial, and we just have a few seconds left, but again, the book is Funnel Vision, and you can go to the website chriskreidler.com, chriskreidler.com. You can buy the book there. You can buy it through Amazon, and I think you plan a series around the main character, Jack Andreas, so we'll watch for those in the future. And who knows, maybe a movie like the next Twister movie. But
that would be awesome.
yeah, it would be. You can go to skydiary.com, too. Chris Kreidler, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety. It's been interesting.
It's great to talk to you, Court. Thank you.
I hope you'll all tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.